Welcome to the LIW MPC Insight session. My name is Jia Tan, a member of the LIW MPC, and I'll be the chairperson for today's session. Today we are very lucky to have highly experienced speakers in the group insurance industry to talk about a hot topic in the market that is currently faced, terminal illness pricing. So recently, the government has changed the legislations around the relief of superannuation due to terminal illness condition. From the 1st of July 2015, a member can now access their superannuation if two medical practitioners certify that a member is likely to die within 24 months of certification. Prior to that, the life expectancy period was only 12 months. So, the first two speakers of the day will be Francis Burgess, Head of Pricing for Pacific Life Re. And then we have Brendan Girding, who traveled all the way from UK and currently the director of Pacific Life Re UK. Francis and Brendan will be talking about overseas stats and some of the trends that they are seeing in UK. Following their presentations, we will have Brad Lewis, who is the head of pricing at Munich Re. And we will have also Steve Varney, the leader for Group Insurance Code at Munich Re. Brad and Steve will be talking about Australia's statistics and how they can use it for terminal illness pricing. If you have any questions, can I ask you to hold on to them to the end of the session, because we have allocated some time for Q&A. And if you do have questions, please also state your name and the organisation you work for before the questions. That will help the presenters. Thank you. Without further ado, I'm going to invite Francis and also Brendan to come up to the stage, or maybe Francis first.
Thank you very much. Clearly, it's a very hot topic in the industry at the moment, which explains why it's a packed audience and set out tickets. It's probably also more of a journey rather than a final answer. So, if you're looking for X, which is the exact answer for the cost of terminal illness, you might be a little disappointed. But we do have some excellent data from the UK, which will form quite a large part of the, perhaps a piece in the jigsaw, which will come to the ultimate answer. First thing is that the UK in the retail sector has experienced a pretty similar sort of thing in terms of the impact of term illness. We'll see in some slides later on, that Brendan can put forward, that the TI in the UK has been quite a big issue, and it's been so probably a couple of years before this. So it's an excellent source of data. And what we're looking at is it's predominantly a survival study. So one of the big issues we have with term illness is once you have a term illness claim in the insurance thing, the person pays out, and then that's pretty much the last we see of them. So we don't really have a good view as actually how long they do survive after the term illness. We know they're expected to survive 12 or 24 months at that time, but what we've got in the UK is actually how long they do survive after that. And then the big question we're talking through, so Brendan will be addressing the UK experience, and then I'll sort of stand up again as well. And basically wrap up how the UK experience, which is 12 months data, can be adapted to the 24 months data, and also talk about a few other issues as we see it in the topic. So the first one is, if you've been in group risk since 2003, like I have, or longer, this topic is perhaps not as new as you first thought. I remember the time when TI was sort of first introduced, sort of about 10 years ago now, and I think the universal consensus at the time was that perhaps 5% would be, to be illness. You had rate guarantees of 3 years or more were actually the norm, and you pretty much expected to remain the incumbent on the scheme for perhaps a contract term of at least 6 years. And when term illness was introduced, the assumption there was that the TPD term illness overlap was perhaps not 100%, but pretty close, and therefore most people didn't do an awful lot of data-intensive pricing, but there was a lot of licking fingers and going on, waving the air, and it was agreed universally among practitioners that it was probably sort of a low sort of 1%. The cost of the TM was sort of perceived to be mainly around the lost interest of time and also potentially lost premiums. So we've got a very different situation now. So the first point of this slide here is just to say that, you know, if you've been in the market for a while, it's sort of this term illness of 24 months and 12 months has sort of come a bit as a surprise, and you're seeing a lot more material impacts from term illness. A lot of those assumptions where TI was immaterial are no longer valid. So term illness as a proportion of death claims is nowhere near 5%. It's been increasing steadily. And contract terms, 2 years or 1 year, and the cost of spreading it over, and then just add a large sort of an education on top, and moving from 12 months to 24 months. So that's the sort of start of the introduction. First part of the thing we've been, we'll be talking about the UK experience, and then I'll wrap up a bit more and see how we can translate it to 24 months.
Thanks, Francis. And thanks, Gia, for making me sound a lot more senior than I really am. just to clarify, I'm not the director of the UK company. I'm going to give someone a call after this. I've moved down to Australia about a week and a half ago, so a lot of new faces in the audience. And apologies if I use any acronyms or anything like that, so I'm familiar, please just stop me. And second apology is that I'm going to be rushing through the slides quite quickly because we have quite a lot of material to get through. Rather than dropping some of it, we thought let's keep it in there so that people can digest it afterwards, come back to us with any questions. So a couple of the slides will sort of skim past. Don't worry, we will make these available afterwards. So as Francis mentioned, I'm going to be looking at the terminal illness comparisons between the UK and Australia, having a look first of all at just sort of how things have changed over time, maybe some of the reasons for that. And then getting a bit deeper into those questions that we try to answer, which is how long after someone's paid their claim do they actually survive for? And Francis is going to look at extending that to Australia. So first things first, what is a terminal illness? So we've got three definitions that we're going to quickly look at. Medically, fairly sensible, it's an advanced disease state from which there is no expectation of recovery. There have been some studies done within hospitals, so typically, if we're looking at a medical definition, we're probably talking about 0 to 6 months. So it's a slightly different time frame that we're looking at. But where they've tried to analyse the expectation versus the actual survival rate of these patients, they find that doctors tend to overestimate survival. And the reason for that is probably that they're trying to give the patient a bit of good news. So give them that sort of optimism that they can make it through and that sort of thing, which... it's probably a bit of a topic for another day, but they are sort of siding with the patient on that side. All right, so given we're looking at some of the UK retail experience, what's the definition of there? So reasonably similar, the illness has no known cure and has progressed to the point where it cannot be cured. And in the opinion of the attending consultant, the illness is expected to lead to death within 12 months. So we'll be looking at a 12-month definition for my part of the talk. So the big question we wanted to answer is it, do they tend to over underestimate that survival?
Just one quick question. So they didn't have it before. So this is an introduction rather than an extension of the period.
So it's been around in the UK for quite a number of years. Can't tell you exactly, but since the 90s or possibly before that. So just going to highlight two words on there. So we've got expectation in the medical definition, we've got expected in the life insurance definition. We're going to see something similar in the Australian definition. I'll pick up on that in a second. But a key question is, what do we actually mean by that word, expected? So if we look at the Australia SIS release, just a shortened version, fairly similar to the UK definition, except we've got two registered medical practitioners, and now we've got the movement from the 12 to the 24 months. At least one must be a specialist in the replaced area. And some insurers require that they sort of agree to the prognosis of the doctor as well. So similarly to the other two definitions, we've got that word likely cropping up. So what do we mean by likely? What do we mean by expected? I think the majority of us are actuaries in the room, so if I ask for two definitions of likely, I'll probably hear mean and median popping up. And that distinction is actually very, very important when it comes to looking at these groups of lives. I'm going to show just two hypothetical survival curves for two different conditions. So say we've got condition A over there. Reasonably believable shape. You've got over about 10 years, you've got everyone sort of dying from this condition. You've got another condition there which people tend to do not so well at first, but then as people recover, they respond very well to treatment and sort of go into some sort of recovery, remission. So if we were looking at the median of those two numbers, we would see that condition A would be 14 months, condition B 9 months. So condition B would meet that definition. It's fairly obvious what's going to happen next. If we look at a life expectancy measure, then condition A is 20 months and condition B is 30 months. So depending on the way that you actually view that word expected, you tend to get very different results. And from speaking to a number of doctors in the UK, what they typically do is look at median survival rates. Part of that is a practicality thing, so we don't normally have life expectancy because that means you have to track people over the entire course of their remaining life. You do get median stats quite easily. So those tend to be used, but because we've got these tails which tend to carry on for quite a long time, there is a big difference between those two things. So just going to skim over the slide, just to highlight a couple of the different claim causes that we see. So there's lots and lots of cancers, all of those are different cancers that we see popping up, so lung being the biggest one. And then we've got a very small proportion of non-cancers, and that's typical of what we see in the Australian market as well. So normally between 90 and 95% of claim causes under a 12-month definition would be for cancers. So the one question is that going to change when we move to 24 months? You should be able to argue that it's not going to change, because if someone's TR in 24 months, they'll be TR in 12 months at some point in the future. But will doctors see that the same way, or will they start saying, you know, we'll let a couple more MOD patients through, a couple more people with heart disease through? In terms of the trends that we've seen, so Francis said back in 2003, we were looking at very, very low proportion of TR claims, and that's consistent with what we've seen in the UK as well. So that's a line on account of the amount of spaces being a high one. That's the proportion of mortality claims, so death and TI, that are due to TI. So we started back in 2005 in the UK around the 10% mark. We're now almost reaching the 35% mark in 2014. Similar thing for Australia, except maybe a few years behind. So you've got different sort of awareness issues, similar to what's been happening on the TPD front. So as people become more aware, you'll see that proportion ticking up and up and up. So although we are at maybe a little bit behind that curve, there's certainly no sign of that sort of tick up just slowing down. I should mention as well before I get any questions that these are both based on very credible data sets, so it's a believable trend. Unless you squint really hard, I think you'll probably struggle to see anything else happening there. So in terms of why that might happen, so there's probably slightly different reasons in the UK where someone goes out and buys the policy versus over here where someone's, you know, by default given some insurance, they might not know about the TI part of it and they'll become aware of that over time. There's a lot of things that can trigger that awareness. In the UK, there's been a lot more IFA and broker involvement. In Australia, you can also have the administration processes which might steer people towards claiming one way or the other. So the question is, how far up can that go? If we'd seen it sort of taper off, maybe it wouldn't be an issue, but we need to make some sort of assumptions about the upper limit of that. So I won't spend too much time on this slide, but the answer is it depends. It depends on the mix of lives that you're looking at. That's just the graph of cancer death prevalence by age from the Cancer Research UK. It also depends on what I was saying earlier about what approach the doctors take. Do they act a bit more sort of professionally and say, you know, I can't really say beyond reasonable doubt that this person is going to die within 2 years. Will they say, you know, I've got a sick patient in front of me, I'm going to probably give them the benefit of the doubt and say that, you know, they've got this heart disease which might kill them within 2 years. So the other reason that we care, so not only are these proportions going up over time, but there is a real cost to terminal illness. So we have new claims, so claims that are brought forward into our risk period on, say, group business, or survivors to the end of a risk period for retail. Higher benefit levels, so you've got mortgage-type policies in the UK, or benefit scales, which typically run down with age in Australia. Potential transfer from TPD, if you've got a lower scale on the TPD side, and then foregone premiums, interest, and higher claims expenses as well. So there is a real cost to all of this, which is why we were interested and why we wanted to do a study. So what we did, we wrote up to a number of different UK life insurance companies, managed to get about 3,500 TR claims over roughly a 10-year period. And what we did next was to say, right, how can we actually figure out whether these people have died or not? In the UK, we've got a very large longevity block, and we regularly do tracing exercises on that to see who might have died that we're not aware of. So we took a similar approach, and we used the same company to trace those lives through so that we can actually see out of the people that we've paid who we'd normally not know anything about what's happened to them and at what time. So in terms of how that works, so first of all, we need a match by surname, full name, date of birth, and gender. And once we have that match, we'll have a check on the name. So you'll have common names like Francis and Steve, and then uncommon names, which is probably mostly celebrities, call the children Apple and North. And depending on which of those categories you fall into, it does a distance check. So if they live reasonably close, then you have a bit more certainty that it's the same person that you're looking at. So we come up with a certainty of the match down there. That's not the complete rule set, but that gives you a sort of feel for the reliability of the results. So after that, we found 80% of people had died, highly certain, a couple in the less certain categories, and the uncertain ones we've excluded because it's difficult to say either way. And we've got 15% of people still alive, but what that doesn't tell us is sort of when everyone's expected to die, how long have the people that are still alive been alive for. So the next obvious thing that we did is construct a survival curve out of that. So we start with the exposure, we've got our deaths, we get our death rate, and from that we construct that survivorship curve. So a couple of key points on this graph, which is just looking over the course of a year. So around about 6 month point, we've got that median kicking in. So by that measure of the median, we're not doing too badly. It's within a year, all seems sensible enough. We start looking a bit further out, we've got 30% alive after 1 year. If we extend it even further, so we've got the 30% point there, 16% after 2 years, and then what you see is that the tail really flattens out. And it seems almost like these people just aren't dying anymore, they've completely recovered. So that gives us sort of the starting point in coming up with the other measure that we want to look at, which is the life expectancy measure. So we know that we've got 10% of people still alive after 4 years, roughly the same after 5 years. In order to extend that further, we have to make a couple of assumptions. So in terms of those future survival probabilities, we could do, assume there's a zombie apocalypse and everyone dies straight away, or you assume maybe the last person dies after 10 years or 15 years, you can do any number of sensitivities. But you need to do that in order to actually come up with your life expectancies rather than just the medians. So what that gives us, even if everyone dies straight away at the 5 year point, we've got a life expectancy of 14 months. 10 years, 17 months, and 15 years, we've got 20 months. So it no longer looks like we're doing all that well against this measure of expected if we're measuring it on a life expectancy basis. And the thing to bear in mind, in addition to that, is that the average predicted survival isn't going to be 1 year in the dark. We're probably looking more in the sort of 6 to 9 month range. So versus that, we're probably about double and then some in terms of how well these guys are actually doing. And part of that goes back to the use of median survival statistics, not only the fact that it's a median, but doctors are using stats from 5, 10 years ago. Treatments have progressed significantly since that point. And we'll see briefly later on, but you do see a very different picture by condition. So conditions where you've had a large sort of forward movement in terms of treatment, you tend to see people doing much better than what they were predicted to do. So that's just monthly death rate, if we zoom in on that. People are doing very poorly at the start, they've got a relative risk of about 400 versus a sort of healthy life. Now, we're not saying that they're healthy by the end of it, so they've still got a relative risk of 20. But you saw from that sort of survival tale that that's not really enough to run down that population of people all that quickly. So these people are still very sick, but a lot of them have started to respond very well to the treatments. So I went on this slide, probably the main thing to highlight, like I was saying before, if you look at breast cancer, they tend to do much, much better than the overall group of people. Versus something like digestive, where seems like doctors are getting it a bit more right. And if you start looking at the literature, you'll see that breast cancer is one of the conditions that's had quite a good surge in different treatments, and people have been responding quite differently to that over the last, say, 5, 10 years from what they were doing before. So a couple of key takeaways just from the UK part of the study. So we've seen that TI claims have increased materially both in the UK and Australia. In the UK, at least, people are living longer than expected. We've got roughly 1 in 10 alive after 5 years. And just going back to the expected point, life expectancy is definitely a better measure than medians of what we mean by expected, but that tends to be ignored. All right, so I'll hand back over to Francis.
Okay, so what we've got there is basically a very good piece of data from the UK around a survivorship curve, but it's not just the only piece of information you need to do to price term illness in the market. So the first one, and it's quite an important one, is the proportion of TI claims over time. So we've seen historical trends, which you can see from the 12 months, it starts off about 5%, it's going up to sort of 25-30% at the moment in the market, and that's quite consistent across different schemes. And it's if you look at the ultimate amount when you get full awareness, that could even rise quite a bit higher. The other thing is the survival rates. So this is a survivorship curve. So I guess this is in terms of the jigsaw I was talking about. The UK survivorship curve, and then extrapolating that 24 months is a key part of the formula. But the other part that drives the cost is the policy length. So if you're seeing, we talked about those components of cost, but we're seeing probably the predominant component of TI being the fact that you're taking on, say, an industry fund with a 1 or 2 year guarantee, you're taking claims that were previously would have been death claims out of your next insurer, and you're bringing it forward into your insurance. So clearly the policy length is also a key factor here in determining what the overall cost is, because that's the period of time for which you're spreading the cost over. And then the other one is TPD conversions. So a large sort of feeling has been that TPD is everything that's turning on this was probably TPD beforehand, and therefore there's this great offset effect from TPD that's reducing the cost. So that comes in there. So a point on the TPD, we've got a lot of data, I suggest, on the survivorship. The one area where this is still evolving is this TPD and terminal illness overlap, and we're looking forward to questions on that towards the end. But one of the things that we just wanted to point out and make out is that there's a big difference between this instance view of the world, where you go, well, someone must be sort of TPD. If they've got cancer, they're going to get TPD first. And then, obviously, going to be 24-month TI, and then 12-month TI, and then they're going to die. So if you look at the progression at the bottom there, that's the third progression, and it's probably an instance view of the world. So if you look at someone's instance, that's definitely the case. There are actually three different progressions if you think about a model that you could have in this particular case. One of them is that you can be 24-month TI before your TPD. It does depend on your cancer, it depends on your lifestyle, how much money you've got, etc. But a key thing here as well in this progression is that what we're dealing with in group risk when we analyse historical experience is notified experience. And just because you might have an incidence-based view of the world that says I am TPD, then I'm 24 months TI, then I'm 12 months TI, doesn't necessarily mean that's what happens when you look at the notified claims, which is after all what you're doing when you're pricing your insurance. So bear in mind the sort of model and how you might get the progressions appearing differently in three different ways. So that's so the other thing is basically we're trying to adapt the results for the portion of TI claims. So what we've got here is a couple of things. Firstly, we're doing this on day one. We're sort of getting and get this sort of takeover effect. We've got a lot of people who wouldn't have been eligible for a TI claim under the 1 to 12 month definition who are now going to be eligible for claim under 13 to 24. So when you first change the definition, you're going to have a whole load of claims that are going to be eligible. But we also expect that in the steady stage, in 10 years' time, when the dust has settled, you're also going to get an increase in claims. So there will be more proportion of people who are obviously 24-month TI than 12. And then another sort of amount assumption you need in your pricing is exactly what is the increase between the two. And you would expect some sort of permanent uplift as well as just the timing effect. You will get a situation where people will sort of recover, but you also get sort of decreased doctor error. So one of the things we expect is that you move from 12 months to 24 months, you're going to get more than a 12-month sort of increase in the amount. So just showing that graphically, this is a 12-month projection, and that's a pretty solid number that's coming from data. A number of funds are showing quite consistent views across a credible data set. And then here's a potential example, and this is probably where we're going more into the territory of assumption from the survivorship curve, we're more data-driven. So you're certainly bringing forward a large number of claims, and then the idea is that the ultimate number of TI claims in 24 months will be higher. So the other thing is we're trying to do is adapt the 12-month survival data from the UK, and what we're trying to do is sort of come up with a stretched survival curve for the 24 months that is sort of sensible in line with the UK. And what we're doing is making sure that the overall life expectancy is probably a little bit more than 12 months overall. So one of the issues we've got is that as a medical practitioner, if you know someone's going to die in the next three or 4 weeks or 3 or 4 months, that's a pretty certain prognosis. As you get to 12 months, it becomes more uncertain. And as you're talking to 12, 24 months, there's a lot more uncertainty for the doctor in making that prognosis. And so similarly, you're going to get a greater level of uncertainty. Okay. And the other thing is that one of the things we'll find out as the data comes in over time, there's an awful lot here about the psychology of the doctor. So at the moment, we've found from studies that the doctor tends to sort of overestimate sort of life expectancy because they see that as a value to their patient. If you have a situation where the patient might be $1 million better off if the doctor makes a certain prognosis, we want to see how that psychologically skews the results. So what we've got here is a 12-month survival curve. And what we've done is we've most effectively scale up by 1.8, which is the sort of the survival curve, which gives you the extra 12-month life expectancy. So we've stretched it a little bit more. It's a little bit more than 12 months, and that sort of allows for the potential for misdiagnosis. Now, this is where we're in the realms of assumption rather than data from the UK, and therefore, as you would traditionally do, you'd end up doing some sensitivities, and we'll show you some more of those. This is a bit of a busy slide, but probably if there's probably two or three slides that you take out of our talk today, it's probably one of the key ones. So if you just excuse me, I'll just take a minute or two to explain it. So we're looking at a two-year rate guarantee contract, which is typical in market at the moment. We're looking at the proportion of TI, and underlying that, we're allowing for the increased 12-month portion trending upwards from 20 to 24. In the third column, we're seeing the shock effect of the 24 months coming through and then reverting back to that sort of extra claims, but not so much. And then what we're doing is we're factoring in the survival curves. One is the UK data and the other one is the extrapolated version. And what we're then doing is we're basically seeing how many people would survive under both the old product design and the new product design. And then you basically get the cost per quarter. So you see that the cost you get between any move from one design to the other is very much depending on where you are and the rate guarantee, etc. So, to begin with, you're going to get proportions of TI of 12 months and 24 pretty much the same. And the real cost comes through in the middle of the contract. And then if you take the sum of that, you get to about a 7% cost of death cost for a two-year rate guarantee. So, just first going through, the cost of 24 months has a number of components. We've concentrated mostly on this transfer cost, which is the idea of death claims being brought forward from another period of insurance. But it's also worth bearing in mind that there are other components of the cost. So another one of them is you're going to be paying out maybe 12 or 24 months earlier than you would have done under a death claim. And if you've got a decreasing benefit scale, that means that the cost of the claim is then going to be correspondingly 2 years younger, and therefore you're going to get a cost from that as well. You've got lost interest, premium, and the expense of claims, and this is sort of quite small, so this is 0.5, and that's consistent to the sort of 10 years ago view of the market that terminal costs were pretty immaterial. And overall, we're sort of saying for a typical, perhaps two-year rate guarantee, you might have a cost of premium of around about 10%. We'll note here that there are a small number of schemes in the market that have death scales that are different to TBD scales. If you have one of those schemes, you also have to allow for another component cost, which is that if you had a TBD claim that's now being paid out as a term illness claim, you're getting effectively double the sum assured you would have done before, and you have to allow for that as well. Now, I said that we've got a very good data set in the UK, and we've extrapolated that to come up with a 24-month survival curve. So obviously in that situation, we wouldn't be actuaries if we didn't do a few sensitivities. So what we've got here is the 24-month term. We've got the stretch factor of 1.8, and that gives us the sort of 10% cost. As I said before, it's very dependent on the term. So if you've got a shorter term, then you've still got that one-off take-off cost that's been spread over half the period. So we end up with a cost of 60% of the debt cost over that one-year period. And then if you look at a longer term, maybe a five-year contract, you still might be looking at 6% of the debt cost or sort of 3% of total premium. And there's a few sensitivities there. So if we looked at a 1.5 stretch factor or 2.1 stretch factor, and there's, a reasonable upper and lower bounds for that assumption, then you're still looking at death costs of 8.5% to 12% around a 10% best estimate. And then finally, Just looking at maybe the expectation between sort of the uplift factor in the long term after you get that sort of initial tsunami of, TI claims is a sensitivity of 7.5. So one of the things that's probably worth, we're going on a journey in terms of the pricing of the 24-month costs, and one of the things that struck me as part of this journey was that the costs, the 24-month, I guess, is just the extra bit that's adding, so it's the icing on the cake. So we've got a situation where the TI proportions have been increasing from 5%, heading 25, you know, projected for some schemes to go 35, 40. If you allow for the survival curve that we've got, even if you don't think that 24 months is going to make any difference at all, even if you thought it was absolutely no difference at all, if you just allow for the data that we've got, if you just allow for the clear trend of TI proportions increasing in the market, if you just allow for the credible data set, which is the survivorship curves, on just a 12-month benefit, and then you allow for maybe a 1 or 2 year rate guarantee, you're getting a cost on TI. That's before trustees decided to move to 24 months. So before you even get to the product design section of your pricing report, in the mortality improvement section or mortality trend section, you should be allowing for the changing proportion of TI and the changing rate guarantee period. And if you're looking at potentially sort of 3% for that alone. So what we've been doing here in terms of this cost here is really the incremental cost. So you saw that on that chart, the two columns, the incremental cost of going from 12 to 24 months. There's a base cost, even if we don't do anything along that base cost is so the starting point is like 2-3% for the cost of that TI trend. And that's based on credible data set, credible trends in TI 12 months, and then we're loading on the 24 months on top of that. I'm running short of time, so I just want to wrap up. A couple of things from a member trustee perspective before I wrap up. So the first thing on the member's perspective is that we're taking this talk almost entirely from the view of pricing actuaries and numbers and what's the cost and what are the expectations. There's a very strong argument from members that if you're going to move the CIS definition to 24 months, you should move the insurance definition to 24 months. I think we should all acknowledge that whatever the cost is, that's going to be the case. You can come up with an argument that there's this sort of criminal law versus civil law argument where the burden of proof should be higher for insurance payout compared to getting access to your own money. That's not an unreasonable argument, but it probably wouldn't be something my grandmother would understand. And then you've got the consistency between superannuation products. So we've come at this probably predominantly from an industry fund mindset where you're looking at 1 or 2 year rate guarantee periods. If you're looking at retail products where the insurer carries on all the way through, this whole idea of takeover costs really is not so relevant. You're looking at more the loss premium, the interest. So if you're BT Super for Life in the retail space, you're going to have a very different concept here than if you're in the industry fund space with a 12-month rate guarantee. We should also look at it from the trustees' perspective. I know there's a number of trustees in the audience. Again, you've got this strong argument for alignment of insurance and CIS definitions. You've got a number of players in the industry fund, the master trust, and the retail sector who've already moved to this definition. You can think, though, if you're a trustee, maybe the issue you should be thinking of is not, am I getting the right cost estimate from my insurer, but maybe the issue you're looking at is that the 24-month TI is predominantly a one-off transfer cost. Mainly, if you look at the 10% estimate we're talking about, we said perhaps 70% of that was coming from this transfer cost. So maybe the way to think of it, if you're a trustee, is that you are effectively strengthening your takeover terms. And that's something you may want to do now, or something you may want to do later. And there's also implications then as a trustee of member equity in terms of changing your insurance costs. You're effectively charging a premium now for something that would have been a benefit for members down the line, and is that fair and equitable? And there's some intergenerational issues that you should be considering. And then the last one is, in this current market environment, it's obviously for trustees to determine when they move to this benefit design, because, is it the right time for them now to effectively augment transfer benefits? And that's a decision you need to make in relation to their current pricing. There is an alternative to just following the CIS definition. It's not the only answer to move to a 24-month. The main issue that's argued is it's wrong for members to have to shut their accounts if they want to close under the CIS definition, and they end up losing the insurance benefit. So you sort of have to align the two. You don't. You could perhaps borrow a corporate-type concept of free cover. If the insurance contract were to continue without premiums after a 24-month CIS payout happened, you could then have that free cover period. You then would get rid of effectively the takeover cost element. You'd still have a loss of premium and side of things, but it would be a very different cost to the market. This takes out a lot of the pricing uncertainty. This product design that you would have underlying under the SIS definition. It is also member friendly in the fact that the member can get access to all of their money now rather than necessarily having to wait until the insurance premium. And it's also pricing actually friendly, and it takes away a lot of that guesswork, which is the 12 to 24 months. So as a possible alternative product, it's something that trustees may want to consider. But here's my last slide. I'm guessing the horse has probably already bolted on this one. The market's probably moved. So while it might be nice to decide about alternative product designs and what we could have done, I guess that was the conversation we could have had 12 months ago. The market's predominantly moved in the superannuation market. The retail's moved, we've seen MasterTrust move, and four or five large industry funds have already moved. So you can see from the cowboy and the horse, the horse is bolted, and all we have left to do really as pricing actuaries is determine what the cost is. Thank you very much. So I'll be introducing Brad and Steve from Munich. Thank you.
Thanks, Francis and Brendan. Although we've looked at Australian data, we have a lot of similarities in some of the things we're going to say. So luckily for you, we're not going to be too contradictory so that we confuse people. So that's a good start. Our agenda is very similar as well. We're going to start with what are we setting out to achieve, what method did we look at, what data did we look at. We'll then share our view of some costs, which aren't too dissimilar, bigger numbers than what we thought when we first set out to look at it. And then we'll also have some concluding remarks and touch on product design as well, so very similar. So the current status, I took a punt that someone would talk about the full terminal illness release definition before I got up, and luckily they have. So I'll just summarise it very briefly. The old SIS being likely to die within 12 months and the new likely to die within 24 months. And the current practice, so we've not just looked at group, we've thought a little bit about what happens in the retail space as well. So within retail, by and large, everyone, certainly within super, uses a likely to definition. So the change there is just going from 12 months to 24 months. In other areas, in some group plans, in some retail outside of super, the base definition is different rather than likely to. It says will die, which is a different definition. And so there's another aspect to consider. So when Steve gets up and talks about our methodology, we'll share some numbers around that change in definition as well. When we started thinking about terminal illness, and this looks very similar to one of your slides. As Brendan pointed out, 95% or thereabouts of terminal illnesses are caused by cancer. And a typical cancer, I guess, path would start with a serious illness. And if you have trauma in a retail product, possibly you can get a trauma product. Then you get a terminal illness diagnosis. And then we split out terminal illness into diagnosis and claim because we know that some people, when they are diagnosed, they choose not to claim, whether that's a deliberate choice or lack of awareness. And then TPD and death. And, yep, TPD might be either side of terminal illness as well. And we've deliberately put death going a little bit beyond the end of the policy termination date, which is where another cost can come in when you add a terminal illness benefit. So that's the path of a cancer diagnosis. And then we thought, well, what is the cost? So we split the cost, what we see the cost, in two parts. The first part, called Part A, is really an acceleration. It's bringing forward payments that you would otherwise pay later. So there's the interest cost. It's the different sum insured between when you pay it and later for a group scheme. It's obviously tend to have downward scale for a retail with typically 5% indexation. It goes the other way, which reduces the cost of introducing a TI. And the third part of the acceleration is there are no premiums in that period that you're paying the earlier claim. The second bucket is really when you will pay a benefit that you otherwise wouldn't have paid. So there's two components. There's one, if someone gets a terminal illness when they're 64 and a half, and they would normally die after 65 when the policy ends, that's a cost that you wouldn't pay if you didn't have a terminal illness. So that needs to be considered. And the other one is a group scheme. So if you're a group reinsurer and the cutoff date in at the end of a three-year period, you're not certain that you will have the cover, then bringing the terminal illness forward brings forward costs as well. That exists now. That exists under the 12-month definition. And so going to 24 months is really bringing that forward. So it brings the acceleration component forward, but it also adds more people who will fall into the second bucket where you may pay a claim that you otherwise wouldn't have. So that's how we see the claims. The approach that we have taken to assess the cost, we've needed to make a number of assumptions, and Steve's going to do the heavy lifting and walk through this in detail, but just to kind of get this little picture, because it's going to sit on all of our slides. The first important thing is how many people are being diagnosed with a terminal illness. Then the second and an important part is, of those, how many will actually make a claim? And there's a bunch of reasons why they may not. And then after that, what is the mortality post being diagnosed with a terminal illness, similar to the survival charts that were previously shown? And the lapse rate. Now, in this case, lapses is in normal lapses, but also policy lapses for a group scheme. So that's kind of the framework that we approach this from. So not exactly the same, but not too far from what Brennan explained. And so now I'm going to get Steve to walk through some of the detail.
So Brad outlined a significant number of factors that we need to take into account, and I think Francis covered off a large number of those as well, a lot of commonality there. So where did we start from? We actually started from, I've just pressed the wrong button, haven't I? Here we go. We actually started from the perspective that most of the terminal illness claims we're seeing are coming from terminal cancer, 90-95% of them. Cancer is one of those diseases where there's actually an amazing amount of statistics available to tell you both about the rate of cancer, the rate of recovery or otherwise from cancer. So we actually started from the perspective of, we want to think about terminal illness within the population as a whole, and then narrow that down to insured lives, to group insurance plans or retail. Now, the best data we found came from a couple of sources. The Australian Institute of Health and Welfare has very good cancer incidence rates information. And then the New South Wales Cancer Council has pretty good incidence rates, but also some really good stuff on survival rates, and they depend on what sort of cancer was diagnosed and what extent it was at when diagnosis was made. We looked at all that data, which fills up quite a lot of spreadsheets, and we spent a lot of time talking to our chief medical officer about what it all meant. When is a doctor likely to certify under either CIS or insurance definitions that somebody is terminally ill? And we actually took a step back and said,
of all these people with all these cancers, which ones are either terminally ill now at the time of diagnosis, or do we expect to become terminally ill over time? So there's someone who's diagnosed with a local cancer may not be terminally ill at the time, but they may progress that way. So I think that's reaching the point that was mentioned earlier, unlikely to recover from the condition. Not necessarily insurance payout or insurance claim definition met, but unlikely to recover. We then said, okay, of those, how many certifications are going to be made? Which ones qualify under the insurance definition? And we looked at that principally from this one-year likely to die basis, the main CIS definition of 18 months ago. But we also varied that and said we'll ask the same questions if it's on a will die basis, because we see that in insurance policies, or if we swap to a 24-month. So what we tried to create was, in the population, which people qualify for each of the various insurance claim definitions, what cancer types are they made up of, because that was very useful to us in looking at survival later on. Okay, we went from there. From the population, we wanted to drop down to insured lives. Funnily enough. So why would your insured lives claims be much lower than this level of people who might be eligible in the population? Perhaps the most obvious one's underwriting effects. If you're looking at your standard retail product, working mortality versus population mortality, if you're looking at a group insurance product. The other things that come into play, of course, are some people regrettably die very quickly after a diagnosis and simply don't have time to put in a claim. Or you just may not be aware that this is available to you. You might be reluctant to actually make a terminal illness claim. There's a degree of admitting your own health status in doing so. And lastly, there might be cultural reasons that it's preferable to wait for a death benefit. A lot of things that cut down the claims. The other things we had to consider was the cancer statistics that are around don't tend to differentiate by smoker status or by occupation. There's a lot of research around about the influence of those factors. So to turn them into usable group insurance rating factors or retail insurance, we had to recognise that and do a few adjustments. We're in calibrating what that, I suppose, partly theoretical framework said we should expect and what we're actually seeing in group insurance plans. We realised that the awareness or reluctance to claim gap is actually quite large. So this is an idealised chart that effectively shows that rise in claims proportion that came up before, and you know, where might it reach. And it's not too hard to estimate where it might get to if everyone claimed the moment they became eligible to do so. Just looking at the terminal cancer claims within your existing death and terminal illness claims, you can work out a ratio. It's the lower bound because there's some people who might not die and get better you need to allow for as well. But you'll find it's quite a high number. Okay, then we moved on to survival rates. And as I said, the statistics have some very good survival rates by stage of cancer. We focused on the distant stage, so this is when cancer is widespread. So perhaps what we traditionally think of as part of terminal cancer. And we added it up across all the cancer types we're expecting all these claims from to get some overall survival rates by age, by gender, and so forth. From an insurance, in swapping from population to insurance, we made the simple assumption that that's the sort of survival rate you will see in an insured population, and then compared it to the statistics we did have available on survivorship, which is some of Australian group insurance plans, some sneaky peeks at your presentation. And we got a reasonable match. We didn't actually expect a reasonable match. All the people who died before claiming, we actually thought meant those who claimed would survive a bit longer, that the match was okay. We did find Australian survival seemed a bit higher than the UK. And so we, possibly definitional differences. And then we repeated this exercise again for those two-year definitions or will die and are likely to die. So we've got a whole bunch of survival curves to help us in our costing. These charts are just indicating that where your claims come from does actually matter. The bars are showing you survival at different years for different extents of cancer. You've got breast cancer on the left, lung cancer on the right, and perhaps it's not surprising why you see a lot of lung cancers come through as terminal illness claims. Those survival rates are very low. The second lowest of all the main types of cancer, I think, with pancreatic being the worst. And similar charts come through there just to show those differences. And the point of this is, as you swap definitions from maybe a 1 year to a 2 year, and you get some of these other types of cancers coming through, so new claims, not claims you may have seen on a 1 year basis, your survival rate is going to shift. All right, we move on to lapse rates, which is the question of if you weren't paying out someone a terminal illness claim, would you eventually have ended up being the insurer or the reinsurer paying that claim, or maybe there wouldn't have been a claim? So this recognises on the retail side the possibility that someone who is very sick would still lapse, possibly due to affordability. Probably a very reduced chance on your normal lapse expectations. On the group side, this is around the plan termination, leaving the insurer or the insurer leaving the reinsurer from another perspective. Now, that's one of the key elements, I think, in the cost. And we've approached this slightly differently when we come on to cost, because what I'm going to show you, I think, is actually pretty consistent with what you guys showed, but this is looking at if you've got a chance of lapse as opposed to cutting off at a point in time. And we're looking principally at the long run costs. Okay, so what did we say? This is for a simple group insurance distribution. We looked at it as a base. Let's assume everyone has the same flat sum insured. It doesn't change with age at all. It gave us a convenient base to start pricing off. And our take was that the long-run level, without that early surge or acceleration in claims, was equivalent to a cost of between 1 and 3% of death premiums. It varied according to age and a few other things. And that was for a will-die definition, so the stricter definitions around in the marketplace. We then found that moving to 24 months added another 1%, and moving to a likely to die basis, throwing about another 1%. So the cost of change is going from the top line for many group funds to the bottom line. And so around a 2% extra cost of claims coming through. Okay, so that was our simple base case of what the portfolio looks like. And then we started varying it and saying what bits really make a difference to your cost. If TPD is present, yeah, you could be accelerating a TPD claim that was likely in 1 year instead of a death claim that might have happened in 5 years. So the cost of changing your term isn't as big as it would have been if no TPD, just death. Drops it down by about 10% or so, depending on how much TPD you have on the members. The unit premium cover scale, so this is the decrease in cover, the fixed $5 a week premium. That can send the cost up considerably. Just add 50% to all those figures you saw before. It's probably one of the most costly product designs to move from 12 to 24 months on. Can't see this one. If the group's a bit older than average, there are different outcomes at different ages. Very young ages, terminal cancer is very unusual, even more. Relatively unusual than dying, so the costs are quite low there. As you get older groups and perhaps less 20, 30-year-olds and more 50, 60-year-olds, your costs tend to go up a bit. It's not huge, it's around 10%. One of our worries is the increase in awareness. You've seen it over time in a few of these charts, just gradual increase in the proportion of TI claims that are happening. there's another 20 to 40% extra cost to come through in future years, is it our view? And it's probably accelerated by actually moving from 12 to 24 months, promoting that to members, increases the awareness, and you don't just get the extra claims in the future. Some of the people who didn't claim in the past and still have to come through as claims, so another acceleration. And then, talked a bit about lapse rates, and that just a 5% chance in your view of losing the scheme can move the cost 15%. And finally, that short-term surge of a few months' worth of all the people who could have claimed on the new definition last year, but couldn't because you've only just introduced it, they don't happen to be dead yet, they all fall in at once. Easily enough to double your costs. If you've only got 6 months to the group plan renewal and you're expecting to lose the scheme, you get some massive numbers in terms of the costs you face. Let's swap to retail insurance. Retail insurance overall, we feel, is actually much cheaper to provide terminal illness on. The main reason for that is sums insured tend to go up because of automatic indexation. There's a lot of death sums insured in modern products that are increasing at 5% a year. So you're actually paying out less, paying out a terminal illness claim in some cases. I'm sure there may be a lot of good advice going to people about wait to put in your terminal illness claim until you've gone past your policy anniversary, you've had the lift in sum insured. But still, if you don't die for 3 years and the insurer's paid out $100,000 instead of $120,000, it's made up for a lot of those costs, of the interest costs of the advancement on a number of people. So retail's broadly cheap. You don't have the issue of the 64-and-a-half-year-old claiming terminal illness instead of dying a year or two later when they wouldn't have had cover, just because so many products go through to 75-95 CSAPs these days. And the chance of lapse is actually quite a bit less. The last point I make, these figures that are up here, they assume that nobody's got an acceleration trauma rider. If you do have an acceleration trauma rider, that's likely to pay out at a much earlier stage of cancer, or just on diagnosis of motor neuron disease, so there could well be no terminal illness cost. But you do see a lot of inbuilt buybacks these days. In the 24 months certification period, there will be people who can claim all their trauma, buy back their life cover a year later, and claim again on terminal illness. But trauma's generally good for terminal illness costs. But there's some negatives there. Now, hand back to Brad at this point.
Thanks, Steve. So Steve really has said that the cost can be quite big, and it actually will vary by plan to plan. And so what it means is we can't stand here and say it's going to be 2% or it's going to be 4%. We're actually, as a pricing actuary, we're going to have to look at every scheme individually and make sure we understand the characteristics of it. So one size does not fit all. The last point I put on this slide was behavioural. Human behaviour is going to have an impact on the ultimate cost, and we acknowledge that we've had to make a number of assumptions in coming up with this, and part of that assumption is essentially predicting what doctors will do. The CIS definition hands over fully to medical specialists to determine whether you're terminally illness. So if you follow that definition 100%, your claims team don't get any extra work. They just have to check the form. And there's a big human behavioural component of that. Until we actually see the experience, we're really not going to know. So while we can do our best to predict it, and we've spent a lot of time with our CMO trying to understand how doctors work, we acknowledge there's a bit of a component of we're going to have to wait and see. In the last few weeks, as we've been thinking about how we cost this, I've been doing a little pop quiz when I meet people, and I've asked not the question on cost, but actually I've talked about, is this a good thing? And the feedback I've got, and I actually had planned to use the word at one end of the spectrum, was the horse is bolted, we just got to price it, so thank you for using that. And the other end of the spectrum was, actually, this isn't good. What can we do about it? We've got to do something about it. And so we thought that the view of the trustee, alignment with paying out benefits, was pretty well articulated. So we thought we'd have a quick look at maybe the alternate side and maybe talk about some of the issues that we see with terminal illness and a 24-month definition. And really, this is a bunch of questions that came out of my pop quiz. Would we even be discussing this if the CIS release of provisions? I can see quite a few people shaking their head. I haven't met anyone who thinks this is a good product design. Talking to Munich Re in UK, they've actually just released a paper there where they're saying in the UK, because of the increasing complexity of being able to predict a terminal illness the further out you go, that we are recommending a movement to 6 months. So it's interesting that we're going the other way. The next point is, can we predict it? I think we all know that we're not that great at it, and we're relying on doctors who don't necessarily understand the statistics and what a median and a mean and an expected is. And what's the impact of fully delegating out, I guess, that responsibility? When we were doing the research, I found, went and looked at a couple of forms to see what doctors actually certified, and there was some pretty interesting ones. In one case, the form that they get given to fill out actually doesn't ask the question about do they meet this definition. It just says, what's your view on the expected lifetime? So that's coming in for the claims team to assess, but under a CIS definition, you won't be able to ask that question. In other cases, I've seen pleas from the doctor of, oh, this person will be treated, and they're likely, if the treatment works, they'll last a long time, but if you could pay them now, that'd be really good because they can spend it while they're healthy enough to spend it. Was one of my favourites. And I guess the last point, how do you price for uncertainty? I think you only have to look at the industry. Whenever there's subjectivity, we tend not to be great. Group TPD, retail disability income, retail trauma. So every time subjectivity comes in, it becomes difficult for us. So we think that while, yes, the horse may have bolted, we think it's worth pausing and contemplating should we all follow. So if you're looking at a group scheme that the cost is 10% plus, actually the trustee has a real decision. That's just shouldn't be an automatic, yes, I'll accept a 10% increase. I thought we'd finish by having a quick look at some very specific examples. So in this case, I thought, well, what should happen for someone who is refusing medical treatment and because of that will have less than 24 months to live? And the first question is, if you follow the CIS definition, should you pay them? Second question is it desirable to pay them? And the third part is, if you decide you don't want to, what wording options might be open to you? So in this case, yes, CIS definition will require you to pay them. And the desirable to pay was based on my pop quiz. It's not a Munich Re view. It's not my personal view. I had people saying yes and no. And I'm sure you'll all probably come to your own view pretty quickly. So in this case, if you decide you don't want to consider paying that out, then a wording option would be something like despite all medical treatment. I think the UK has palliative care as a requirement for their terminal illness, so there's a potential to add that in. But it will mean, even if you stick with 24 months, there's a difference between when the super will be paid out and the benefit. I then looked at four others. So just quickly, someone who had terminal illness and now is in remission, so they could no longer be denied terminal illness, but they have in their hot little hands a certificate that says they are terminally ill. Someone who has advanced cancer with a 45% 2-year survival rate. What about someone who's aged 64 and got a terminal illness on a 2-year basis? Should they be covered? And what about someone who has a certification, but for whatever reason, you are doubtful? might be that the specialist has said yes to the right question, but in everything else they've written, the claims guys know that there's a lot of doubt. So what do you do? For all of those, if you follow the CIS definition 100%, we pay all of them. My pop quiz, I found yes and no to all of these. So again, it's a bit hard to get everyone on the same page. And for all of these, I think there's something that you can consider adding, whether that's making sure the certification is only within 3 months or some other time frame that you think is suitable. The middle one there is just whether you go with the likely to die or will die. Will die is a tougher test. Should we consider stopping terminal illness a certain period out? This is very common in other jurisdictions around the world, very common. And then the last one, should you put in something like give yourself the right to let your own CMO or your own claim staff have the ability to have a say, which is quite frankly fraught. When I talk to the claims people around, they say the appetite of anyone in the industry to really push and fight a terminal illness claim is very, very, very low. But in one-off cases, it may be helpful. So I think that's where we might wrap up and hand back to Gia.
Right. That was a very comprehensive presentation. So thank you to Brad, Steve, Francis, and Brendan for the presentation. I think we've all gone into a journey for terminal illness now, from showing the proportion of terminal illness, how it's increasing over time, and then moving to survival probabilities, and then the pricing elements to price the cost of TI. On top of that, we have options on what we can do about the TI as well. So we have about 15-20 minutes for Q&A. If anyone has questions, again, please state your name and also the organization you work for. And also, because this session is currently being recorded, a mic will be passed around to the room as well. Charles?
Hi, this is Charles from Cominsure, and I've got a question for Steve. Steve, you mentioned that the will die definition is tighter than the likely to die definition, and therefore there's a differential in terms of the pricing cost impact. So I was just wondering, in practice, how would these two definitions be administered differently? Is it that we require the doctor to certify rather than at a 50% or a median, we require them to certify at a 90% percentile? And if that's the case, how are we able to influence doctors or control doctors to administer terms in the way that we would like them to?
Yeah, the last part you asked, influence the doctors to do what we'd like them to. I think we've got very little chance of that. The differing outcomes we're seeing are because of the differing wordings that we have the question, is somebody likely to die in 12 months, or are you saying they will die in 12 months? The reality of the words is you can't say someone will die in 12 months unless you've got either a murder planned or perhaps the last week or two of life, which I understand is reasonably predictable. But you find that doctors in general, and this is across all doctors, if you did enough doctor shopping, perhaps you could get signed off in a few ways. I don't know, but pretty confident of death within 12 months is perhaps what we're seeing coming through under that will die definition, or very confident. So it might be an 85% instead of a 50. It'll differ a lot by doctors. It'd be perfectly reasonable, I think, for a doctor to say, likely to die, will die, they're the same thing to me. Another doctor will say they're very different things because they're not well-defined words, but we're seeing around a third less claims on will die basis than likely to die. So likely to die is 50% above will die.
So it's sort of making the doctors think twice with a stricter definition. Or some doctors. Imagine some doctors.
Potentially so, yes.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Actually, I might get the speakers to sit at the front so that everyone can see them. And ready for the next question. Anthony?
Thank you. Anthony Bryan from APRA. Maybe a couple of observations and a couple of questions to get you covered. First of all, we're dealing with a piece of legislation. You've got trustees who've got an obligation to meet that legislation. So you have a real challenge to think about what can you do whilst you're still helping trustees meet that legislation. There's enough issue with the definition of TPD, which also is something we do engage in the insurance industry with doctors a great deal about the definition of able to work or not. Dead or not is a little bit easier, I think. So if we're dealing with TPD, we should be able to do if they're likely to live or not. And I think the greatest areas of issues is where they will die unless they get a transplant. Are they terminally ill, or are you going to wait to see if that lung turns up before they die? My understanding of the reason why we went 24 months was an incident which involved the friend of the wife of a Member of Parliament who notified the fund they were terminally ill and they were within a month of death by the time the payout was made. So have we analysed how long it takes from notification to acceptance to the payout to meet the customer's need? And then my main question for it is, the UK data, has it come from an environment where there's been a substantial change in the underlying claims experience? In group insurance in Australia, we've seen the rate of claim go up incredibly. We've seen the tail on claims, TPD claims, the number of suicides in early durations. Those people who opt up when they take their cover are dying at 50% higher rate than those who take default cover. So what about the moral hazard selective exposure of people who can go and join a fund when they're terminally ill and get a benefit? How do you factor these sorts of things in?
Could you just clarify the question part of that rather than the
so, notes? Is the UK data from a stable environment? And so when you're comparing Australia versus UK, we're in a really volatile environment, so maybe there's a much bigger understatement of the cost when you translate UK to Australia.
Yeah, it's a very fair point. It is quite a stable environment in the UK, so we did try and look at the survival curves by different years of claim. That didn't really highlight anything going on there. We looked at it by a number of different factors, by age and gender. There were some differences, as you would expect. Say, younger people tended to do better than older people because they respond to treatment a bit better. Some slight differences with gender, but very fair point that in sort of changing times and where you are able to have a higher level of anti-selection, which you can't necessarily do in a retail-type policy because you're underwritten, you might expect that will show a high survival rate.
Was there any investigation into the UK data once you'd identify the lies to sort of say, you know, we are getting better with medical science to be able to predict early death, and therefore there's a greater proportion of awareness of when people are terminally ill and or our treatment is keeping them alive longer, and these are the sorts of factors that are impacting, and therefore we've got a built-in trends of a greater proportion of people are going to be terminally ill but survive longer, and therefore this gap is widening over time?
Yeah, I think that's what we saw to some extent. So my sort of understanding, we can't say for sure, that tail, that 10% tail of people, it could be due to things like changes in treatments for different conditions. We definitely spoke to a number of doctors who had that sort of view. And then you speak to the doctors who are making the decisions, and they're going on median survival statistics from, you know, 1995, and you say, have you factored in all these new treatments? And the answer is normally no. So we did quite a big piece of work in the UK to actually address the claim forms issue. So rather than just saying, you know, is this person likely to die within 12 months or 24 months, tick box, yes, easy, give a couple of lines. Asking questions like the 90 percentile, what's the sort of maximum expected life expectancy that you could see this person having? What sort of treatments are they currently on? What's their performance status? So that's something that's quite often not factored in, I think, and there's very reliable gradings that you can use to actually assess, you know, is someone still active, mobile, back to the TPD point, are they still at work or not, or are they lying in a hospital bed somewhere? And it's that sort of thoroughness that wasn't always there coming through on those claim forms, and it sounds like you guys have seen similar in the Australian forms that you've looked at there as well, so...
Well, I have a question for Brett, probably, because you touched on that slide. So the very last slide, you actually proposed a few good policy wordings around how to tighten it for the TI. Have you revised the cost of the TI based on that policy wording change?
For only for the middle one, which had the difference in the will die versus the likely to die. The other ones we haven't had a go at pricing that yet. Realistically, they're not going to cut it in half or even 20%. It's playing around the fringes. The other components that Steve walked through is where the main cost is coming from.
I have a similar question from the webinar. So it's Adam Fuska. So this is a question for Francis, similar as well about the savings. What about the TPD offsets? What is the expected impact of that?
Yeah, I was expecting this question. So the key issue, I suppose, in Adagio is that we're assuming that the TPD offset is going to be consistent from what it has been historically around the 12-month to the 24-month. And that's implicit, I guess, from using the survivorship that's been extended out to a period that's 12 months consistent. It's probably, for us, the biggest area of uncertainty at the moment. If you also talk around the practitioners in the room, and then we're aware there's a very wide range of opinions around TI. I guess your opinion on the TPD versus TI offset is critical, depending on whether you're in the optimist or pessimistic camp in terms of that 0 to 10% price range. For us, we haven't seen any compelling evidence that is a material TPD offset. There's certainly, if you think about it, yes, you might be seeing a lot of TPD offset in the TI claim portions, 5, 10%, but if you're seeing TI portions of death creeping up to 35%, and we saw the mini slide with the grey line, it's almost identical, we haven't even talked to each other, but it's almost identical to our expected level of proportion of TI claims. So fundamentally, we see that the TI portion of claims could hit that sort of 50 or even higher sort of proportion as a potential case if you look at what's surviving in cancer stuff. If you've got TI at that sort of portion, you're not seeing, I don't think, anymore a huge offset between TPD. If you look at the TPD cause of claims, I know it's a very much, sorry Adam, I know it's an each depends answer, but if you look at the cause of claims by a certain funds, the TPD can be in the musculoskeletal, they can be the stress related, they can be very different, whereas the TI claims are mostly cancer driven. And getting back to that point, all the data we've seen that might suggest that overlap is predicated on some sort of incidence view of the world, and I think in group risk you're seeing notified view of the world. So if we take, the best thing we could do essentially therefore is project the TI proportions forward and to allow for the survivorships based on the UK data and all the cancer getting very similar answers, and therefore that implicitly assumes that the same historical level of TI, TBD is being projected into the future. You could argue slightly higher, slightly lower, but we didn't see any compelling data that enabled us to make a sweeping discount on TI as a result of TPD based on some feeling that TPD was the offset. But if anyone's got compelling data on that, we'd love to see it. I hope that wasn't too much of an it depends answer for you, Adam.
Just to add to that a little bit, in terms of some of the numbers that we have been seeing, so if you look at the breakdown of death claim causes, focusing specifically on the cancers, so looking at cancers within death as well as TI, what you should see is that there's still a whole lot of cancers classified as deaths, which points to the fact that you probably, before you can allow for a whole bunch of TPD cancers, which would have been paid anyways, you probably have a much bigger issue on the death side, where probably between 30 and 50% of the cancers on deaths are already being paid as TI, but you've got that fairly large chunk which are still there. Maybe some of those they are going to die too soon. Others there might be the cultural reasons, but certainly a large majority of those could easily convert, and that's a much bigger proportion than the sort of 5 to 10% of TPD claims that you see as being cancers.
Hi, this is Piri from Common Shore. I think there's a question for Francis as well. In the UK, I'm just wondering what are some of the thinking around moving to a 6-month period? Is it just to increase the certainty of being able to define something as TI, or is there some other studies that have given rise to that thinking?
I'm going to phone a friend.
So I'll start on that one, and then I think I'll pass to my colleagues at Munich as well. We've actually been asked both ways in the UK. So there were some companies that thought about 24-month TI, and we fortunately managed to convince them that it's not a good idea, and they didn't end up adopting it. In terms of the move to the 6 months, so the the sort of data that we've been showing today, that's quite widely available in the UK now. I've done some of the presentations over there, and you do get a lot of interest from people saying, you know, is this a sustainable benefit design when you've got these increasing proportions? And if you look at the medical studies as well, so again, looking at the shorter range of things, but so if you take people who are expected to die within 0 to 3 months and people expected to die within 3 to 6 months, and then draw some error bars around that from medical studies that they've actually done, you see those bars just expand so rapidly. And now we're moving to 12 months and yet again to 24. So I think that's definitely part of the reason is the greater uncertainty. Perhaps there's some sort of price competition as well going on over there, but there has been interest on both sides of that.
Yeah, that was a paper from Munich Re that I mentioned when I was talking, where Munich Re has put a recommendation to the UK market to go to 6 months. And the driver is definitely all about getting much more certainty in costs. The UK market, as I understand it, is very, very, very price competitive on mortality and mortality only with terminal illness attached. And so the margins are very thin. The business changes very quickly from reinsurer to reinsurer. It can get renewed every year or two. And so the ability to actually control and understand the costs is a big driver in the UK, and hence the push from Munich to get it to an area where it is much more certain.
Right, I have another question then. Maybe for Steve, because you touched on that. So I guess one of the biggest element is members' awareness on the TI. And there were a few reasons that you put down why they didn't put a claim for TI and appear as a death or something else. Have we done a stats on how many are unaware, how many are due to by choice, how many they die before they actually have a TI claim, make a TI claim, sorry?
Not in that level of detail. So looking at notification delays between the day that somebody got certified as terminal illness and when they actually put in their claim form suggests that, now this varied a lot by fund, anywhere between 2 and over 4 months on average, so a lot of time for people to die. And on the survival curves, those first few months after diagnosis can be very critical. Mortality is very high, so you can lose 20-25% of the potential claimers purely in those first few months, the time taken to make a claim. But then in terms of awareness or reluctance to claim, we haven't looked at how do we divide that up or what are the detailed reasons behind it.
But that would be interesting to do, because then you know who are very sticky and won't affect the awareness, and who will be affected by it.
Yes, very, very fair point. If it's all down to reluctance to claim and that's due to attitudes that won't change, then no need to allow for any more awareness or growth in claims. But we do suspect that's not the case, because we do see still climbing every year.
Yeah.
Just to add to that, we've done a similar study in Ireland, and interestingly enough, despite having a very similar definition to what we found in the UK, their proportion sort of ticking around between 0 and 5%. So perhaps that's the cultural reasons, reluctance to claim coming through there, or just lower awareness in general, but definitely is a big, big impact on that.
Any other? Yep.
Hi, Grace Nath from OnePath. There was one of the slides talked about how you would price industry fund and mass trust differently. And later slides covered how the reasons for difference between one industry fund and retail. But could you explore a bit further between industry fund and mass trust, why you price it?
Yeah, so the main reason was probably the tenure and contract length, which you were amortizing the cost. So I suppose the premise of our point was that there's the predominant cost is the takeover cost of claims being advanced from another insurer. I was making perhaps a sweeping generalisation that a large number of master trusts or exposure in the market are predominantly owned by bank distribution, and that the likelihood of the master trust moving from in-house insurers to other insurers in the market was therefore pretty low. So in that context, where you might have a 5 or even 10 year sort of expected tenure, the cost of a one-off takeover type cost spread over that would be then considerably smaller than if you are an industry fund who's looking at a 12 or 24 month rate guarantee. So I don't see the overall cost being necessarily an awful lot different, but I do see the per annum cost spread over the premium expectation being quite different.
Charles from Commissure again, probably following on from that takeover cost point, Francis. I suppose that the underlying concern or assumption is that we're going to lose the fund immediately after the next 2 year rate guarantee period. Therefore, some of the costs will be brought forward needs to be spread over the next 2 year rate guarantee. This is more of a discussion point than a question. Does that cause a bit of a catch 22 situation where if you apply a loading, you actually increase your chance of losing the plan? What are your thoughts around that? And how to set that 10-year assumption?
Yeah, you're right, there's a little bit of circularity there. Potentially some of the thoughts around that though in the market would be that you're essentially, or maybe 70% of the issue is a takeover cost, then where you have introduced those sort of things, then maybe some exit penalty is appropriate. So if you thought to the trustee, you could be having that conversation saying, from your member's point of view, if you felt that it was in your member's interest to do this, we would have a potential cost at exit as a result of paying death claims from a previous insurer. If you were to potentially put an exit penalty at that point, then we wouldn't need to spread that cost over to this period of insurance. We could then basically allow for it appropriately, and that might be seen, therefore, as the new insurer's cost come in as part of the cost of taking over that contract. And therefore, you might be allocating the cost more fairly to the correct periods of insurance. And that is something you could be having as a conversation with your trustee.
Right, I think that's all the time we have for today. Let's give another round of applause to our presenters. Thank you for your time and the discussion that we have here today. On behalf of the LIWMPC, we hope to see you next year in the new year. Thank you.